KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM are turning up the heat this winter with a stacked lineup of shows. At the Broom Factory, don't miss out on Metal Fusion cellist extraordinaire Raphael Weinreth Brown on January 23rd. On February 14th, you can see local rockers Casador take the stage, while Canadian punk rockers The Flatliners are live on February 20th. And don't miss out on Daniel Romano's Outfit on March 13th, followed by Schoolhouse and Braden Lamb on March 15th. And the winter season rounds up with The Sheepdogs live at Kingston Grand Theatre on March 16th. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm a real estate person at heart, and it's all about location. And I said, look at this location on the sea. Look at this beautiful piece of property, what it could be for so many people. It'll be so, so great. People that are living so poorly are going to be living so well.
As President Trump lays out his vision for a post-war Gaza, what some might call Trump Gaza, we'll speak with TropSite News reporter Sharif Abdelkaddous about his new investigation, leaked documents. Planned community in Rafah would force Palestinians into Israeli panopticon. Then to Minneapolis, we'll talk to the lawyer for Nakima Levy Armstrong, who is still in jail after she was arrested after peacefully protesting in a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as a pastor.
David Easterwood is a pastor here. He is also the director of the field office for ICE in St. Paul. So someone who claims to worship God, teaching people in this church about God, is out there overseeing ICE agents.
We'll also speak with a union member who's part of one of the many unions joining today's Day of Truth and Freedom, an economic blackout to protest the surge of ICE agents into Minnesota. And today marks the 50th anniversary of the death of Paul Robeson, the great actor, singer, athlete, scholar, blacklisted and hounded by the government for his political beliefs. We'll look at a new book, Kings and Pawns, on how Jackie Robinson, the Brooklyn Dodgers star who integrated the all-white major baseball leagues, was pressured to testify against Robeson before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee.
I've been asked to express my views on Paul Robeson's statement in Paris.
One man is now a legend. The other was erased from history.
We'll speak with acclaimed sports journalist Howard Bryant, author of Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, hundreds of businesses are expected to close today as part of a one-day economic blackout to protest the ongoing ICE immigration crackdown. Organizers of today's strike include faith leaders and unions. They're calling for people to not work, go to school, or shop. Businesses closing include the famed Walker Arts Center. On Thursday, the prominent Twin Cities civil rights activist and attorney, Nakima Levy Armstrong, and two others were arrested on federal charges for their role in peacefully protesting inside a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as a pastor. The three face charges under the FACE Act. That's the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, a law written to protect abortion clinics. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced Levy Armstrong's arrest, then the White House posted an AI-generated image to make it appear Levy Armstrong was crying after her arrest. Her skin was made to look darker. The Justice Department also attempted to bring charges against the journalist and former CNN anchor Don Lemon, who covered the church protest, but a federal magistrate judge rejected the request. We'll speak to Nakima Levy Armstrong's lawyer and get an update on today's economic blackout after headlines. Outrage is growing in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, after ICE agents detained a 5-year-old boy named Liam Ramos and his father, who's an asylum seeker. Photos from the scene show a masked agent standing next to Liam, who's wearing his backpack and a blue winter hat with bunny ears. He just returned from preschool. The father and son were then quickly sent to a detention jail in Texas. On Thursday, Vice President J.D. Vance visited Minneapolis and defended ICE for targeting the boy's father and detaining the preschooler.
So the story is that ICE detained a 5-year-old. Well, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to let a 5-year-old child freeze to death?
Local officials in Columbia Heights condemned the detention of 5-year-old Liam Ramos. Rachel James serves on the Columbia Heights City Council. She described efforts by neighbors to protect the little boy.
I heard one neighbor say, I live in this house. I'm part of this family. I can take him. Let him come to me. I heard another neighbor on the other side say, I have the forms. His mom signed the forms. Let me have him. I know him. I know him. I kept saying, stop, wait. He can go with us. He can go with the teachers. And then they took him over to the car, and he was just standing there. And then they quickly put him in the back seat and drove away.
On Thursday, the lawyer for the Ramos family, Mark Prokosh, said Liam and his dad had come to the U.S. in 2024 from Ecuador seeking asylum.
Liam and his dad did enter the United States at a port of entry to seek asylum through the CBP One app at the Brownsville border crossing. So they did everything right when they came in. They used the app, they made an appointment, they came to the border and presented themselves to Customs and Border Patrol. They've shared all of their information with the government, and they were following the process. They were just trying to secure safety and persecution for their family from their home country. But ICE didn't care about the fact that they had those pending claims and then just arrested them.
On Capitol Hill, 7 Democratic lawmakers joined Republicans to pass a $1.2 trillion government funding package that includes $64 billion more for the Department of Homeland Security and $10 billion more for ICE. The Democrats voting for the measure were Henry Cuellar and Vicente Gonzalez, both of Texas, Jared Golden of Maine, Marie Glusenkamp Perez of Washington, Don Davis of North Carolina, and Laura Gillen and Tom Suozzi, both of New York. In news from Gaza, Israeli tank shelling killed 4 Palestinians Thursday. The killings came as President Trump was launching his so-called Board of Peace in Davos, Switzerland. At the ceremony, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, outlined his vision for turning Gaza into a glitzy seaside resort filled with futuristic high-rise buildings.
In the Middle East, they build cities like this in, 2-3 million people. They build this in 3 years. And so stuff like this is very doable if we make it happen.
Kushner said the first phase of the project would be rebuilding the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which was leveled by Israel. The Rafah border crossing with Egypt is expected to reopen next week. Many Palestinians fear Israel and the U.S. will move to forcibly displace them from Gaza. On Thursday, Israeli President Isaac Herzog met in Davos with the leader of Somalia's breakaway Somaliland region. Israel recently became the first nation in the world to recognize Somaliland as an independent nation. They've been reports. Israel wants to expel Palestinians en masse from Gaza to Somaliland. This all comes as Palestinians in Gaza struggle to survive with little food or shelter. This is Mohammed Al-Kudra in Khan Yunis speaking about Trump's plan for Gaza.
No matter how much he says, it's all in vain. Why? Because we as citizens aren't seeing any real change on the ground. The suffering remains the same. Rain, there are no tents, no shelters, as you can see. The destruction, wood, we don't have that. President Trump announced that the second phase had begun, but we haven't seen anything. People in Al-Mawasi are living in tents, displaced. People in the east can't reach their homes. You can hear the shooting, the shelling, day and night, martyrs.
Russian, Ukrainian, and U.S. negotiators have begun meeting in Abu Dhabi for the first trilateral talk since Russia invaded Ukraine almost 4 years ago. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said he hopes the talks are a step towards ending the war. On Thursday, Zelensky met with President Trump in Davos, with Russian President Vladimir Putin met with Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, in Moscow. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the Trump administration's been plotting ways to topple the Cuban government in the wake of the U.S. abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The Journal reports the U.S. is, quote, searching for Cuban government insiders who can help cut a deal, unquote, to push out the current leadership. On Thursday, The Guardian reported the U.S. used a similar model in Venezuela. Four sources told the paper that Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, and her powerful brother, Jorge, had pledged to cooperate with the Trump administration if Maduro was removed from power. Rodriguez is now serving as Venezuela's interim leader. The United States officially left the World Health Organization Thursday. Public health experts fear the U.S. decision will hinder global public health initiatives. Dr. Thomas Frieden, the former head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, called the withdrawal a grave error. He said, quote, health threats do not respect borders, and weakening global cooperation makes Americans less safe, unquote. The Trump administration's ordered a review of almost all federal funding going to more than a dozen Democratic-led states. The move comes just days after President Trump threatened to suspend federal funding for sanctuary cities and states at the end of the month. States that could be impacted include California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, and Washington, as well as Washington, D.C. Former special counsel Jack Smith testified before Congress Thursday and defended his decision to indict Donald Trump for seeking to overturn the 2020 election and removing classified documents from the White House.
Stand by my decisions as special counsel, including the decision to bring charges against President Trump. Our investigation developed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump engaged in criminal activity. If asked whether to prosecute a former president based on the same facts today, I would do so regardless of whether that president was a Democrat or a Republican. No one should be above the law in this country, and the law required that he be held to account. So that is what I did.
During the hearing, Washington Congressmember Pramila Jayapal questioned Jack Smith about the importance of accountability.
How would you describe the toll on our democracy if we do not hold a president accountable for attempting to steal an election?
My belief is that if we do not hold the most powerful people in our society to the same standards of the rule of law, it can be catastrophic.
A major Trump billionaire ally is now the partial owner of the social media platform TikTok. A group of investors, including Larry Ellison's company Oracle, agreed to a $14 billion deal to give them control of the U.S. version of the platform being spun off from ByteDance, a Chinese-owned company. In 2024, Congress banned TikTok, claiming national security concerns over its ties to China. But Trump had allowed the platform to keep operating as a deal was worked out. Ellison is also the largest shareholder of Paramount, the parent company of CBS. And in the Philippines, a radio journalist has been sentenced to between 12 and 18 years in prison in a case widely condemned by press freedom groups. Frenchy May Cumpio has been jailed since February 2020, when she and four others were arrested for allegedly having ties to the Communist Party of the Philippines. She was convicted of terror financing. UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Opinion Irene Khan has criticized Cumpio's prosecution, saying the charges were filed, quote, in retaliation for her work as a journalist, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at the Trump administration's contested plans for a post-war Gaza. As President Trump formally inaugurated his so-called Board of Peace at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Thursday, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, presented his vision of turning Gaza into an upscale, futuristic seaside resort with gleaming skyscrapers and entirely new cities, an ambitious proposal that would require an investment of at least $25 billion. Kushner outlined the so-called Gaza Master Plan as he presented slides, one of which showed a map of the besieged territory divided into different zones. Kushner said the first phase of the project would be to rebuild the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which was leveled by Israeli attacks. The Rafah border crossing with Egypt is expected to reopen next week. Families in Gaza fear Israel and the U.S. will move to forcibly displace them to another country. This is Jared Kushner laying out his plan.
We've developed ways to redevelop Gaza. Gaza, as President Trump's been saying, has amazing potential, and this is for the people of Gaza. We've developed it into zones. In the beginning, we were toying with the idea of saying, let's build a free zone, and then we have a Hamas zone. And then we said, you know what, let's just plan for catastrophic success.
President Trump presented his concluding remarks on the plan Thursday, saying, quote, we're going to be very successful in Gaza.
I'm a state person at heart, and it's all about location. And I said, look at this location on the sea. Look at this beautiful piece of property, what it could be for so many people. It'll be so, so great. People that are living so poorly are going to be living so well.
This all comes as Palestinians in Gaza struggle to survive with little food or shelter due to Israel's relentless blockade of humanitarian aid. This is Mohammed Al-Khodri and Khan Yunis responding to Trump's plan for Gaza.
No matter how much he says, it's all in vain. Why? Because we as citizens aren't seeing any real change on the ground. The suffering remains the same. Rain, there are no tents, no shelters, as you can see. The destruction, wood, we don't have that. President Trump announced that the second phase had begun, but we haven't seen anything. People in Al-Mawasi are living in tents, displaced. People in the east can't reach their homes. You can hear the shooting, the shelling, day and night, martyrs.
For more, we're joined by Sharif Abdelkadous, the award-winning journalist and Middle East North Africa editor at Dropsite News. His new piece is headlined, Leaked Documents, Planned Community in Rafah Would Force Palestinians into Israeli Panopticon. He's joining us from Los Angeles. Sharif, thanks so much for being with us on Democracy Now! Start off by responding to what happened yesterday in Davos, Switzerland. President Trump, surrounded by many autocrats of the world, signing on to a charter agreement for the so-called Board of Peace, which Trump will lead even beyond his presidency, lead indefinitely. He personally has veto power and is in charge of the money, apparently $1 billion a seat for those who will be part of this Board of Peace. If you can respond to that and then lay out what you've learned from leaked documents.
Right. Well, it's $1 billion to have a permanent seat. People who signed up get 3 years. But, you know, if we look at the charter of the Board of Peace, there's no mention of Palestine. There's no mention of Palestinians. There's no mention of Gaza. There's no mention of the right of return. There's no mention of the right to self-determination. What it does say is that, you know, Trump is chairman for life, and it gives him these, you know, king-like powers where he can only be replaced if he resigns or if he is deemed incapacitated under—but it needs to be a unanimous vote that is, you know, it's kind of unattainable. He can appoint new member states. He can veto any decision. And so you have this Board of Peace, you have what's called the Founding Executive Board underneath that, that has people like Jared Kushner, Marco Rubio, and others on it. And then you have something under that called the Gaza Executive Board, which is made up of Palestinian technocrats that are supposed to implement these policies. So this is almost a farcical manifestation of colonialism in the 21st century. It's kind of like a parody of a colonial body. You know, if you had proposed this a few years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room, except that now it's actually real. And at the event yesterday, you played a clip of it, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, you know, delivered this presentation of what he called the master plan for Gaza's redevelopment and reconstruction. And yeah, you saw these kind of, you know, these renderings of high coastal towers and mixed zones and so forth. It looked like an AI fantasy. And let me just say, one of the slides in the presentation included Arabic script incorrectly written in reverse, so from left to right. Arabic script is written from right to left, and with the letters disconnected. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to take these people seriously. I mean, they're buffoonish. But the problem is that they control the largest military and economy in the world. But what we actually, you know, when he talks about residential zones and the future of Gaza, we actually now have a glimpse of what is actually being planned. And it is extremely frightening. It's very Orwellian. So first, what we have to understand is that Gaza has effectively been cut in half. So after October 10th, the Israeli military withdrew to what's called now the Yellow Line, and they occupy and control over 50% of the Gaza Strip. And analysis of satellite imagery by Forensic Architecture that we published at Dropsite News shows how Israel is physically altering the geography of the land in that part of Gaza, east of the Yellow Line, that it does control. So what they're doing is they're constructing a lot of military infrastructure. There's been 13 military outposts built just since the ceasefire. So now there's something like 48 or 50 military outposts in this area. They've also built roads that are being connected to bases and settlements outside of Gaza in Israel. And what they're doing is essentially establishing facts on the ground. This is what Israel always does. Facts on the ground that will eventually become permanent. And actually, just yesterday, we found out that Israel is digging a trench that is many meters deep along the Yellow Line in Gaza, basically to prevent Palestinians from crossing from one side to the other, to the side that Israel controls. So Gaza is literally being cut in half with a moat. So this is the new reality. And what they're doing, in addition to this construction of military outposts and roads, is also systematic destruction of Palestinian property, of buildings, and of infrastructure. And what we found, what Forensic Architecture found through the satellite analysis, is that there's 1 square kilometer between two military corridors in southern Gaza, in Rafah, where Israel is engaged in a pattern that's not visible anywhere else. What they're doing is they are raising the land, they're compacting the ground, and they're clearing the rubble. And they're doing this in a way that suggests this is the site of the first so-called residential zone or planned community where it's going to be built. And we know that they're starting in Rafah. And so what will this so-called planned community look like? Last week, the Civil Military Coordination Center, the CMCC, which is a U.S.-led body, held a presentation for this so-called planned community. Now, the CMCC was established by CENTCOM a week after the ceasefire went into effect. It's led by a U.S. Army Lieutenant General, you know, and it's supposed to oversee the and monitor the implementation of the ceasefire. It's located in this, you know, big warehouse in southern Israel. And what last week they held this big presentation for this planned community that's supposed to house up to 25,000 Palestinians in Rafah. And we obtained leaked documents of this presentation. And they kind of very meticulously outline what this area is going to look like. It goes through, you know, the municipality, the economy, health, education, law and order. And after actually reviewing a transcript of these materials, which we sent to Jonathan Whittall, who is a former senior UN official, you know, in Palestine from 2022 to 2025, he said that these new communities built on the rubble of people's homes are not only governance labs to test ultimate control and subjugation, but they're also the reincarnation of refugee camps. So we can go through, you know, some of what these documents show. So let me just briefly say. So first, it provides a set of criteria for deciding which Palestinians will be, quote, invited to live there. And this includes undergoing security checks to prevent the entry of what they called Hamas elements. It doesn't specify who's going to be doing these security checks. But historically, in Gaza, the movement of Palestinians, for example, in and out of Gaza, has always been controlled by COGAT, which is the branch of the Israeli military that oversees the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So to enter the so-called housing zone or planned community, Palestinians will have to pass through a security checkpoint, and everyone entering will be registered with biometric documentation to enable them to move around, to enable them to access services. And that registry will be based on Palestinian ID numbers in coordination with COGAT. So, you know, the Israeli military already has an incredible amount of monitoring and surveillance of Palestinians in Gaza, but this gives them, yet another layer of monitoring through biometric documentation. For the economy, for example, it brings all economic transactions under increased surveillance. So Gaza, you know, historically has a cash-based economy. Now, the Palestinians living in this zone will be used something called electronic shekel wallets to do transactions. It also says that residents should be able to import products into Gaza, but those products will be subject to security checks at the crossings. It makes no mention of the fact that Israel controls all the crossings. And as we know, for the last 20 years, they've enforced a siege on Gaza where they prevented many goods from coming in.
Sharif,
go ahead, Grant.
Yeah, Sharif, if I can just interrupt you, I'm just trying to get a sense of the issue of the so-called Palestinian technocrats that are supposedly implementing this. Could you talk about that aspect of it and the relationship of the so-called technocrats to the resistance forces within Gaza?
Well, I mean, these are different people, among them Ali Shaath, who is the head of it, who's a former member of the Palestinian Authority. You know, he's the one who announced at the event through video link yesterday at Davos that the Rafah border crossing will be open in both ways next week. They're selected to, implement these policies on the ground. Originally, the idea was that different Palestinian factions would appoint this kind of committee through a democratic process, but that didn't happen. They were just selected by the U.S., by Israel, and so forth. The reaction of Palestinian factions to their appointment has been actually interesting. They haven't outright condemned them for joining this. Hamas put out a statement that seemed semi-supportive of them. And I think, they've been put in a position where any Palestinian kind of input to try and get some aid into Gaza, to try and ease the suffering of Palestinians, to try and help engineer what the future of Gaza will be, was kind of welcome. But the problem is that they are, multi-layers down in this hierarchical structure, this colonial mandate structure that is overseeing Gaza. You have the Board of Peace, you have Trump as emperor of it, you have this founding executive committee, and then, they're under that. They have absolutely no sovereignty, no control, and no real say over the decisions of the lives of Palestinians in Gaza.
And you've written that this first proposed residential zone is sometimes referred to as the Emirati compound. Could you talk about the role of the UAE in all of this?
Yeah, it's referred to in the presentation as the Emirati compound. It's unclear, why that name was chosen. There is the Emirati Field Hospital in Rafah that is not far from this site where this first zone is being built. Now, under the education part of this presentation and this is perhaps the kind of like the most Orwellian part of it, it says that they should create schooling and a curriculum that, quote, will not be Hamas-based, but will follow culture of peace principles, for example, modeled after the UAE, end quote. Now, that phrase, a culture of peace, is mentioned in the normalization agreement between the United Arab Emirates Emirates and Israel that was signed in 2020 as part of the Abraham Accords. Now, since then, the UAE has normalized relations with Israel more than any other Arab country. They have very robust trade, tourism, defense deals, surveillance, like tech deals. And it seems that this idea of, you know, the education idea for this housing zone is aimed at promoting an Emirati-inspired re-education program that will promote normalization with Israel. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about this presentation is that it also says that, you know, the land on which it's being built, they need to examine the private rights of Palestinian property holders so they can see about mechanisms for compensation to these, you know, whoever's land it once was. You know, they have the nerve to mention private property rights of Palestinians in Gaza, where nearly the entire population has been displaced, mostly multiple times. Nearly the, you know, every building has been damaged or destroyed outright. And, you know, there's a genocide where Israel has created the conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians. And so they coldly talk about private property rights as if, and compensation, as if this genocidal war that we've all witnessed for over 2 years never happened. But essentially, you know, that's the vision of what's to come. We heard Jared Kushner say, you know, we're not going to do the free zone and the Hamas zone, and he's referring to those two sides of the yellow line, which is kind of how it stands. You know, one side where most Palestinians are and the other side that's controlled by Israel. He said, you know, they say catastrophic success, and you saw the rendering showing all of Gaza. I don't think that's what's actually going to happen. We're seeing now, as I mentioned before, there's a trench literally being built that's splitting Gaza in half. Israel is consolidating control. And what you're going to have is these Orwellian housing zones where Israel and outside forces have complete economic, social, and security control over every aspect of the lives of a new generation of dispossessed Palestinians who are corralled into these spaces. And then in this kind of like other half of Gaza, you're going to be left with Palestinians living in a wasteland where no construction is allowed to be conducted, that's under constant assault by Israeli bombs, where there's hardly any food, there's hardly any shelter, and they're, you know, left to survive under conditions of genocide. Sharif, and this is the future that they're trying to write for Gaza.
Sharif, we just have a minute, but I had to ask you about the attacks that continue in Gaza, killing at least 11 Palestinians Wednesday, including three journalists who are working with the Egyptian Committee for Gaza Relief. Mohammed Keshta, Abdul Rauf Shath, and Anas Gunaim were killed when an Israeli missile struck their vehicle. Shath was a contributor to CBS News, Agence France-Presse. He had just gotten married. Mohammed Mansour of the Egyptian Committee for Gaza Relief condemned Israel's attack on the journalists. This is what he said.
What happened is a very big crime committed by the Israeli army by targeting a crew belonging to the Egyptian committee. This crew was not firing rockets nor fighting the Israeli army. The Egyptian committee's crew was in a humanitarian mission. This crew is searching day and night for a shelter to house our people.
Sharif, can you tell us about these three journalists? Again, according to the International Federation of Journalists, at least something like 258 journalists and media workers have been killed in Gaza in the last 2 years.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is Mohammed Ishta, Anas Ghunaim, and Abdul Rauf Shath, who was a freelance cameraman, longtime cameraman for CBS News and Agence France-Presse. And they were killed while they were in their car recording footage of a tent encampment for displaced people in central Gaza. They were killed about a mile away from that camp. The Egyptian committee that hired them, that they were working for, said the car was clearly marked, and yet the Israelis bombed it anyway. And this is part of a pattern that we've seen over the past 2 years, where the Israeli military has killed an unprecedented number of journalists with complete impunity. And it came as world leaders are gathering in Davos and talking about, you know, so-called board of peace and so forth. And it's sad to say that these types of killings of journalists, of Palestinian civilians every day, hardly make waves anymore. It's become normalized in the world for Palestinians to die. And the world has allowed this to happen. And this is, you know, yet another blow to the journalistic community in Gaza that has suffered more than we've seen, you know, in any part of the world in generations.
And more than just a blow to the journalists of Gaza, but to the journalists of the world. Sherif Abdelkaddous, we thank you so much for being with us. Award-winning journalist and Middle East, North Africa editor at Dropsite News. We'll link to your piece, headlined, Leaked Documents, Planned Community Rafah Would Force Palestinians into Israeli Panopticon. Next up, we go to Minneapolis. We'll speak with the lawyer for Nakima Levy Armstrong, who's still in jail after being arrested for peacefully protesting in a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as pastor. Stay with us. Ali Arslan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Outrage is growing in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, after ICE agents detained a five-year-old boy named Liam Ramos and his father, who's an asylum seeker. Photos from the scene show a masked agent standing next to Liam, who is wearing a backpack and a blue winter hat with bunny ears. He just returned from preschool. The father and son were then quickly sent to a detention facility in Texas. On Thursday, Vice President J.D. Vance went to Minneapolis and defended ICE for targeting the boy's father and detaining the preschooler.
So the story is that ICE detained a five-year-old. Well, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to let a five-year-old child freeze to death?
Local officials in Columbia Heights condemned the detention of five-year-old Liam. Rachel James serves on Columbia Heights City Council. She described efforts by neighbors to protect the boy.
I heard one neighbor say, I live in this house. I'm part of this family. I can take him. Let him come to me. I heard another neighbor on the other side say, I have the forms. His mom signed the forms. Let me have him. I know him. I know him. I kept saying, stop, wait. He can go with us. He can go with the teachers. And then they took him over to the car, and he was just standing there. And then they quickly put him in the back seat and drove away.
On Thursday, the lawyer for the Ramos family, Mark Prokosh, said Liam and his father had come to the U.S. in 2024 from Ecuador to seek asylum.
Liam and his dad did enter the United States at a port of entry to seek asylum through the CBP One app at the Brownsville border crossing. So they did everything right when they came in. They used the app, they made an appointment, they came to the border and presented themselves to Customs and Border Patrol. They've shared all of their information with the government, and they were following the process. They were just trying to secure safety and persecution for their family from their home country. But ICE didn't care about the fact that they had those pending claims and then just arrested them.
This comes as hundreds of businesses are expected to close today as part of an economic blackout to protest the surge of ICE agents in Minnesota. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But first, we're getting an update on how the prominent Minneapolis civil rights attorney, activist, and ordained minister, Nakima Levy Armstrong, and two others were arrested on federal charges for their role in peacefully protesting inside a St. Paul church where one of the pastors, David Easterwood, also leads the local ICE field office in the Twin Cities area.
David Easterwood is a pastor here. He is also the director of the field office for ICE in St. Paul. So someone who claims to worship God, teaching people in this church about God, is out there overseeing ICE agents.
The activists involved in the protests now face charges under the FACE Act. That's the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, a law written to protect abortion clinics. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced Levi Armstrong's arrest. Then the White House posted an AI-generated image to make it appear Levi Armstrong was crying after arrest. The Justice Department also attempted to bring charges against the journalist and former CNN anchor Don Lemon, who covered the church protests, but a federal magistrate judge rejected the request. We go now to Minneapolis, where we're joined by Jordan Kushner, civil rights and criminal defense attorney who is helping to represent Nkema. We thank you so much for being with us, Jordan. If you can start off, you were with her when she was arrested. Is that right? Can you talk about the AI-generated image? Can you talk about her wanting, saying that she would turn herself in, but they said no, because they said they were after her over the last few days, and what she was doing in that church?
That's correct. The arrest was a horrible ordeal. She was and some other people in her group were staying in a hotel. A group of FBI and Homeland Security agents busted into the hotel the night before her arrest, roughed people up. They were thrown out by the management. Later on at 3 a.m, someone left Nkema Levi Armstrong's room. The police agents tackled her violently and took her to a detention facility before they realized that she wasn't Nkema Levi Armstrong. So she was obviously terrified about turning herself in. A legal team, including myself, went to the hotel that morning. We reached out to agents to try to arrange for her to turn herself in voluntarily at the federal courthouse, which was only about 6 blocks away. They put the U.S. Attorney for the District of Minnesota, Trump appointee Dan Rosen, he called me himself. I made my request to him. He said it was very reasonable, and he was just going to call me back in a few minutes with the specific logistics. Then he calls back and says, oh, we're not going to let her turn herself in. We need to arrest her at the hotel. So she needs to voluntarily leave the hotel room and turn herself in. So after he talked to his bosses in D.C., he had completely reneged on his commitment. They then sent agents up there to the hotel room to arrest her. One of the agents was filming the arrest. As they put her in handcuffs, he was filming it on his cell phone. Never seen anything like that. They can have their body cameras. This was completely unprofessional. He said he was just doing it because of instructions, and he promised it wasn't going to go on Twitter. Nevertheless, it went on Twitter. It went on the Department of Justice's Twitter, so this was their trophy. And then, as you said, the White House subsequently altered the video to make it look like she was crying. I observed the whole arrest. She was dignified, rational, calm, and reasonable the whole time. It just shows the complete political motivation of the government making this a circus. This has nothing to do with enforcing the law. It has nothing to do with protecting anyone's religious rights. It's about fascism. And in fascism means part of that is that the government makes their own narrative. They invent reality, and they're literally doing that with an AI video. And so what this is about, yeah.
And Jordan, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about the charge that that she's been arrested on, and basically a statute that has its roots in the Reconstruction era to prosecute members of the KKK for terrorizing Black Americans.
Yeah, she's charged with conspiracy to violate civil rights, conspiracy to violate constitutional rights of other people. Namely, the claim is that by protesters going into a church to raise objections to how this church conducted its business, with Nkema Levi Armstrong being a reverend herself, that somehow deprived the people in the church of their right to freedom of worship. It is a farce. It was passed to really protect people's constitutional rights. That's what she's charged with. The government also sought to charge her with another offense under the FACE Act, which involved, obstruction of someone else's exercise of their religious practices. The magistrate refused to sign on to that charge. So we're left with the conspiracy to violate constitutional rights. This was an exercise of free speech. They were exercising their own constitutional rights. It's unheard of for people to be charged with a criminal offense for a free speech protest like that. That's illegal, peaceful protest.
Jordan, yeah. I was just watching Right Reverend Craig Loya, who's the 10th bishop of the Episcopal Church in Minnesota. He talked about what's happening. The immigration crackdown is a campaign of reckless cruelty. He refused to condemn what Nakima had done, said that it's time, and we've seen this with the Catholic bishops as well, saying it's time for us to, he said, put our bodies on the line. I want to end just by saying we wanted to have Nakima on this morning, but she's still not out of jail. We have 10 seconds.
Yeah, the magistrate ordered her release. The government did a maneuver where they appealed. So it's being reviewed by a judge and waiting for a judge decision about whether she's going to be released. So the government used more manipulative tactics to keep her in jail when there was no basis whatsoever. No one is detained on a case like this.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Others arrested included Shanti Louisa Allen, a St. Paul school board member, and activist William Kelly. Jordan Kushner, thanks so much for being with us. Civil rights and criminal defense attorney representing Nakima Levy Armstrong, who's still in jail after being arrested last Sunday, after being arrested yesterday for peacefully protesting at St. Paul Church Sunday, where a top ICE official serves as a pastor. We're going to stay in Minneapolis for the next 2 minutes, where we're joined by a union leader. Many people are saying today they plan to do nothing. They're not going to go to work or school or shop or as part of an economic blackout to protest the surge of ICE agents in the state. It's being called a day of truth and freedom. Some call it a general strike. Organizers include faith leaders, scores of unions, including the AFL-CIO. We go to Kieran Knutson, president of the CWA, Local 7250. Lay out what you're calling for.
Thanks a lot for having me, Amy. Today, after weeks of living under the heavy weight of this racist campaign of terror by ICE agents in the Twin Cities that have torn apart families, have brutalized people and murdered people, today the working class of Minnesota, of the Twin Cities, is standing up and refusing to go to work, refusing to go to school, refusing to shop. And for once, we're going to flex our muscle that we contribute to this society every day. Nothing runs without the working class in this country. And today, we're going to show our power.
And what specifically are you calling for people to do? And how was the coalition built around this issue?
Well, in the Twin Cities, there's been activism and organizing of this generation. You know, going back to prior to the George Floyd uprising, of course, the George Floyd uprising was a key moment in Minnesota's history, in this country's history, and many of the organizers have, you know, experience from that, and that created a network of organization and experience and confidence to be able to go forward with this kind of organizing. This has never been done before, though. This is unprecedented in our generation, where we're asking people not to go to work, and there's going to be hundreds of thousands of workers today that will not go to work because they support the demand for ICE out. ICE is deeply unpopular in the Twin Cities, even hated because of their brutality, because of their tactics, because of the murder of Renee Good. And today is a chance to actually use our power in a way that will catch the attention of those rich and powerful who, you know, live off of our labor every day. And it's going to show the community what power we do have and what we can do to fight back against ICE.
Kieran Knutson, we want to thank you so much for being with us. President of the Communications Workers of America, Local 7250. Next up, well, today, 50 years ago, Paul Robeson died, the acclaimed actor, singer, activist. We're going to speak with the author Howard Bryant about his new book, Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. Stay with us.
Were you there when they crucified me?
Were you there when they crucified my Lord, sung by Paul Robeson? He died 50 years ago today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Yes, today marks the 50th anniversary of the death of the great actor, singer, athlete, scholar Paul Robeson. At one point, he was world famous. You probably recognize his voice from this 1936 film, Showboat.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Old Man River, that Old Man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing.
Paul Robeson singing Old Man River and performing in Showboat. Yes, Paul Robeson was the son of an escaped slave. He was attacked, blacklisted, and hounded by the government for his political beliefs. For years, Paul Robeson was tracked by the FBI, as well as the CIA, the Department of State, numerous other government agencies. Together, they compiled tens of thousands of documents on him, which they used to bring him before McCarthy's HUAC. That's the House Un-American Activities Committee. In 1949, Robeson was effectively blacklisted. In 1950, the government revoked his passport. For 8 years, he was barred from travel, a prisoner in his own country. Now, Jackie Robinson, the Brooklyn Dodgers star who'd integrated the all-white major baseball leagues, was hailed as a national hero in 1949 for testifying against Robeson before HUAC.
I've been asked to express my views on Paul Robeson's statements in Paris.
One man is now a legend. The other was erased from history.
Today, we look at the fascinating new book out this week, Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. We're joined now by the book's author, Howard Bryant, currently the sports correspondent for Weekend Edition at National Public Radio, also the author of over 15 other books. Howard, welcome to Democracy Now! What an amazing book, the story that you tell. Tell us the story of Paul Robeson and Jackie Robinson, how you decided to focus on both and what they tell us about America.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on the show. It really does feel like what is past is prologue. So much of working on this book of Paul Robeson, who, of course, was a victim in the center of a lot of the McCarthyist tactics that we see today, facing off against Jackie Robinson, who really did feel compelled by his employer, by Branch Rickey, the president of the Brooklyn Dodgers, to testify against Robeson to show that African Americans were loyal to the United States after Paul Robeson had given a speech in Paris in 1949. These two giants who had never met one another were really placed in opposition to one, you know, to each other in front of the most notorious government body that this country's ever produced. And this book is really the story of these two giants on opposite sides of the political spectrum in 1949, but actually had much, much, much more in common than we would have thought.
And could you talk about why Branch Rickey tried to insist that Robinson testify, especially given the fact that the, for instance, the Communist Party had played a major role in attempting to integrate baseball in the 1940s.
That's right. Well, I think that's exactly why. I think once when the amazing thing, one of the things I really enjoyed about working on this book was how Branch Rickey's version of the integration story has essentially been treated as the only version. And so much of his motivation for signing Jackie Robinson, at least the public version, had been that Rickey had this amazing moral compass, when actually the biggest reason that he felt compelled, he did have a moral compass here. He did really, you know, go up against his fellow owners who saw signing Robinson as a huge betrayal of them. They wanted to keep the game all white. But one of the biggest reasons was the fact that Branch Rickey in Brooklyn, huge labor area, really progressive, very strong left-wing progressive politics. They were pressuring the Dodgers more than any other team in baseball to be the ones to integrate. And Ricky really had no, I wouldn't say he had no choice, but he absolutely was under pressure. It wasn't simply just his moral compass. It was the fact that the pressure from political groups from the progressive side really, really pushed to make this happen. That's how movements change.
And in terms of the what Robinson actually said in Congress, and did he have second thoughts later in life about his role?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things for Jackie Robinson was the fact that he never wanted to testify in the first place. He felt obligated to Branch Rickey. And later on, after he had testified against Paul Robeson and after the violence that had come after his testimony, two very bloody riots in Peekskill, New York, followed Jackie's testimony. And his legacy never really survived this. It was something he didn't really want to do, but he felt a loyalty to Branch Rickey. He felt a loyalty to say something on behalf of Black Americans. And his widow, Rachel Robinson, who, by the way, is still alive at 103 today, believed that there was nothing that Jackie would have wanted to take back more. Between that and his support of Richard Nixon in 1960, that these were the two pieces of advice that Rachel Robinson felt that did not help Jackie and haven't helped his legacy.
Howard, we have students come in to watch the show every week, and a group of eighth graders came in, and I said, how many of you have heard, I said you were going to be on the show, have heard of Jackie Robinson? Almost everyone raised their hand. I said, how many of you have heard of Paul Robeson? And almost no one raised their hand. So I think it's really important for you to give us the history of Paul Robeson. He was perhaps the most famous Black American in the world at a certain point. And talk about what it meant for him to have been so gone after by the CIA, the FBI, and having his passport revoked because he was a world-famous actor and singer.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of what is, once again, what is past is prologue, and what you feel is impossible is very possible. I think one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was to really make it clear how similar the times were between the 1940s and the Paul Robeson McCarthy era, and what is happening today in terms of the assault on education and higher education, the assault on civil liberties, the forcing of loyalty oaths, all of this playbook, the closing of the borders. So much of what is taking place that took place then is taking place now. And when you look at somebody like Paul Robeson, who is a giant, who is one of the most accomplished Americans this country's ever produced, he is not just the talk about Jackie Robinson integrating the major leagues in 1947. Well, Paul Robeson integrated Broadway in 1943. Paul Robeson was a lawyer, a Columbia-educated lawyer. He played in the National Football League. He was one of the greatest college football players of all time as an All-American in 1917 and 1918. This is a giant of a man. And so to see how powerful those political forces are that silenced him and really did everything it could to erase him so these young kids today don't know who he is tells you about the importance of maintaining stories. And as the great Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus has always said, history writes people out of the story, and it's our job to write them back in. And 50 years after Paul Robeson's death, it's time for a reappraisal of one of the great Americans.
And in 1949, Life magazine ran a spread of people they considered dangerous and un-American. The list included figures like Langston Hughes and Albert Einstein. Can you talk about the parallels you see with the media in 2026 and the complacency and even cooperation with the Trump administration?
Well, complacency, cooperation, and that was one of the things that was so compelling about working on this, because the history is not some old relic. It's not really dusty. Every time I was working on a chapter, I said, this feels like today, and this sounds like today, and this sounds like today. And when you look at the complacency that we have today, so many people look back at that time and said, how did we allow that to happen? But the same thing is happening right now. You see the, especially in media, and especially with the public, I think people become numb to it. And
Howard,
if it's not happening to them
there.
Specifically.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you so much. People have to pick up your book and read the rest. It is fantastic. It's called Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. That does it for our show. Happy early birthday to Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
On Saturday, February 7th, the Carr Harris Cup returns to CFRC 101.9 FM. Tune in at 7 p.m. to catch the 140th anniversary clash between the Queen's Gael